Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Kristen. So excited for this episode.
Today, we'll be diving into the first of a two-part series in which we discuss and provide updates on the OECD's two-pillar solution to help address tax avoidance, ensure coherence of the international tax rules, and ultimately a more transparent tax environment, the BEPS 2.0 initiative. Today, we'll cover the first pillar of the initiative. The goal of Pillar 1 is to expand the taxing rights of market jurisdictions while providing certainty with respect to the taxation of income related to certain baseline distribution and marketing functions. Today, we'll discuss the current landscape and the potential future of Pillar 1. For our discussion today, we're joined by Michael Plougin, a principal who has just returned to us here in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. Prior to rejoining KPMG, Michael served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Tax Affairs at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. In that role, Michael served as the top U.S. negotiator to the OECD on its two-pillar tax reform plan and was responsible for Treasury's international tax regulatory agenda and bilateral tax treaty program. We're really excited to welcome Michael back to both the firm and the podcast. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Kristen. Great to be back at KPMG, and I'm excited to be back on the podcast.
And we're excited to have you, Michael. Clients have been asking me every day, when is Michael coming back and who are you? They keep on asking me, but they're excited to have you back. Before we dive into Pillar One, can you talk a bit about your time at Treasury and what work you were doing there?
Yeah. So first of all, I just have to say that my time at Treasury was really a wonderful experience. And I feel really fortunate to have been able to go back to Treasury, having been there earlier in my career in the Obama administration as well. And Gary, you know, you've spent time at Treasury. You know, it's just a great place to work. It's a really talented team of people dedicated to serving our country. So I can't say enough good things about the people at Treasury. And so during my time there, obviously the negotiations on the two-pillar solution took up a lot of attention, took up a lot of time, and that was really the focus of my time there. That's obviously not the only thing that Treasury was doing on the international side while I was there. Treasury recently relaunched our bilateral tax treaty program, which is really exciting. It's a big deal. We finally got the Chile treaty approved, and Treasury is now in negotiations with a few different countries. So it's really nice to have that program up and running again. There are obviously a lot of international questions in the Inflation Reduction Act, in CAMTI, and the stock buyback excise tax, as well as just a lot of backlog in terms of TCJA implementation. One of the big things we were focused on while I was there that I was not able to get out were proposed PTEP regulations, but I understand they're hard at work still on those. And any day now is what I understand.
So it sounds like you weren't that busy at Treasury. You got plenty of sleep. If I remember my time well, I was overworked and underpaid.
Yeah. And
it is amazing how many people give their time and their thoughts and wisdom to the government for not much pay. So welcome back again. We're excited. Let's talk about Pillar One. Pillar One, most people associate it with Amount A, but there's also an Amount B. We'll talk about both, and they're both important. Let's talk about Amount A first. Can you give us an overview?
Sure. So Amount A is really a reallocation of taxing rights among jurisdictions. It would create a new taxing right for essentially market jurisdictions that expands beyond physical presence tests, like the permanent establishment test. It would also allocate a portion of the largest and most profitable companies' residual profits to the market jurisdictions under this Amount A taxing right. And so the threshold for application of Amount A is for groups that, on a global basis, have revenue of over 20 billion euros and a 10% return on sales. So the residual is the return above that 10% return on sales. The idea in the October 2021 statement is that over time, that threshold would be reduced to 10 billion euros of revenue. So it would expand. But the idea was to try and keep it a relatively small group because this is a fundamental shift in how countries go about taxing cross-border income. And so wanted to really sort of start small and prove that it could work.
So Amount A has been controversial in the U.S., particularly among Republican politicians, because while the U.S. is a huge market economy, it's an even bigger residence jurisdiction. Most of the companies that would be subject to Amount A are U.S. multinationals. Is that true?
Yeah, it's about half. It's about just half. Under half, according to the analysis that I've seen.
But the thought is the U.S. is a net loser in tax revenue under Amount A. If that's true, what is the U.S. getting out of Pillar 1 Amount A?
Maybe just talking a little bit about the first part there. So it would be approximately half of the in-scope groups would be U.S. parented groups, but approximately two-thirds of the in-scope profit is from U.S. parented groups. That was one of the things that drove a lot of people's concerns. The revenue estimates on Amount A, right? If you look at JCT's revenue estimate, they say sort of best guess that the U.S. would lose just over $1 billion of revenue, which in the context of the corporate income tax is not a very big number. But I think the more significant part of their analysis was that there's a huge uncertainty in that estimate. It could be significantly positive. It could be more significantly negative. There are a lot of limitations on the data used to create that analysis. So just to say, it's not a foregone conclusion that the U.S. would be a big revenue loser under Amount A. But in terms of what the U.S. is really trying to get out of Amount A, I'd say it's really about stability of the international tax system, right? Over the past, especially 15 years, we've seen countries engaged in unilateral measures to try and assert additional market-based taxing rights. We've seen just an explosion of cross-border tax disputes. The drivers of Amount A are really the same as the drivers for those unilateral measures and those cross-border disputes. And so the idea is to say, let's address these concerns. Let's have an agreed allocation of taxing rights, and let's have certainty and stability for the international tax system and for U.S. businesses. In addition, obviously, the U.S. wants to make sure that existing DSTs are withdrawn and that new DSTs are not put in place and that other kinds of unilateral measures are not put into place. And then finally, as you said, is Amount B, which really is part of the same idea that we want certainty and stability. The idea behind Amount B is to take transfer pricing disputes for baseline marketing and distribution off the table and just say, look, we're going to have basically a formulaic way of determining the returns in those cases.
That's really helpful, Michael. So let's go on to sort of the state of play. In October 2023, the OECD issued a draft of the multilateral convention to implement Amount A and received comments from various jurisdictions. The OECD has stated that they're working to address the comments and are committed to having the multilateral convention signed in June. Is this one of those situations where the OECD says to expect the convention in June, but they're not saying which June? I mean, when is this? When is this coming out, Michael?
Well, I don't know is the short answer. But I know that the countries are working in good faith to try and reach a deal that they can sign, but we haven't gotten there yet. And actually, the deadline that the inclusive framework set was a two-phase deadline. They said, we're going to have the final text by the end of March of 2024 so that we can then sign by the end of June. And the reason for that two-step deadline is most countries, including the U.S., it takes a while to go through the formal process of getting approval to sign. You have to have an agreed text, and then in the U.S., it has to go through the State Department. They have to make sure that everything works and that the administration is fine signing it, and that takes a couple of months, usually, and then you can get to signing. And so they missed that end of March deadline to get to an agreed deal. Now, the co-chairs of the Inclusive Framework made a statement a little while ago saying that the Inclusive Framework is nearing completion of the negotiations, and they're still trying to reach a final agreement by the end of June with a signing ceremony as soon as possible after that. But just a few days prior to that, Secretary Yellen and Italy's finance minister publicly raised concerns about being able to get to a final deal on Pillar One. Secretary Yellen specifically named India and China as hindering a deal and said they needed to come on board in order to get a deal done. And I think whether they reach a deal or not by that June deadline will really depend on how those countries respond. If they come on board, I think the Inclusive Framework can reach a deal. If they don't, that's just not a credible deal for the U.S. India and China are the two largest countries in the world by population, and India actually has two DSTs. So if they don't sign on, that's not going to be a sustainable deal on Pillar One. Maybe they get to a deal that the countries say they can sign sometime in June, late June. I think there's a real deadline there because to reach an agreement. Because in July, you've got the meeting of the G20 finance ministers, and that often drives the deadlines at the Inclusive Framework. And then after July, you're getting pretty close to the U.S. presidential election. And I sort of go back and forth as to whether it makes it easier or harder to sign at that point. But I do think that it will be politically challenging for the U.S. and other countries to sign so close to the U.S. elections.
Yeah, I've heard about this election. Michael, what's the holdup here? What's taking so long to issue this convention?
As far as I understand, it's not really anything new. It's red lines that have been relatively public knowledge for quite a while. So on the U.S. side, there are basically four sets of key issues. One is the definition of DSTs, and that was something that a lot of stakeholders commented on after the October 2023 draft was released, that the definition of DSTs certainly was at least ambiguous, but probably was not sufficient to capture even existing DSTs, much less the kinds of things that the people might be worried about in the future. There are a number of reservations in the document by Brazil and India and some others about primarily treatment of withholding taxes, and that's a set of open items. There is an open question as to the treatment of Puerto Rico for Amount A purposes, with the U.S. position being that Puerto Rico is part of the United States and for Amount A purposes needs to be treated as part of the United States. And then finally, and I understand this is the biggest sticking point, it's Amount B. From a U.S. perspective, the U.S. wants that to be mandatory for countries to implement if they sign on to Amount A, so that it will take those transfer pricing disputes just off the table, save resources, provide certainty for taxpayers.
It sounds like there's a lot to resolve, but even if the U.S. signs the convention, what then? Doesn't the convention have to be ratified by the Senate? And as far as I can tell, it being possible to get 67 senators to agree that puppies and babies are cute, how does this work? What's the end game here?
So as we talked about, the first hurdle is getting to signing, and maybe they'll get to signing, maybe they won't by June, and that will really depend on whether those open issues are able to be resolved. But as you say, if the U.S. is able to get to signing, it would still have to be ratified by the Senate and or approved and implemented by Congress. And I actually hear still a lot of confusion about that topic. And I probably bear some blame for that because I think our talking points were maybe a little bit confusing and overly technical. But there's no scenario in which Pillar One can enter into effect without congressional approval and implementation. That it can't happen. And so if the MLC is not approved by Congress, then it won't enter into effect in the US. And actually the way the draft MLC is set up, it means that the MLC can't come into effect anywhere. I think other countries recognize that because approximately half of the groups in scope are U.S. groups and approximately two-thirds of the profit, that Amount A just really doesn't work without the U.S. participating. And so the MLC just would never enter into effect if the U.S. does not adopt it. But if that doesn't happen, if the MLC doesn't come into effect, the drivers behind Pillar One don't go away. Countries are still very focused on their taxing rights as market jurisdictions. One of the things that became really clear to me in my time in the negotiations is that more and more countries view themselves primarily as market jurisdictions with respect to multinationals. It used to be that at least among OECD countries, there was some amount of parity that they viewed themselves as, well, you've got the headquarters of one multinational, I've got the headquarters of another multinational, and basically the existing international tax deal works in that context. But more and more countries view themselves as not having a sort of parity in that system and viewing themselves primarily as market jurisdictions, and they want to assert taxing rights on that basis. And then I think the question is, what happens if either we can't get to signing or we don't implement Pillar One? We're likely to see countries resume enacting unilateral measures. The Pillar One negotiations really put that on pause for a few years. And my perception is there are probably a few countries that will be looking to implement DSTs as we currently understand them, but probably a lot more countries that are looking to implement withholding taxes, other source-based or market-based taxing rights. And you really see that in the UN discussions that are going on right now. There's a big push for more withholding taxes and those sorts of things. And I think we're going to see that come to the fore. I would say the one that I'm most concerned about is Canada and its DST. It appears to be moving forward with its DST, and that's really going to force the hand of the U.S. Trade Representative, which has already found other very, very similar DSTs to be discriminatory and burdensome to U.S. commerce. And so the USTR is going to, like I said, be put in a pretty tough spot in that regard and have to take very seriously the potential of finding the Canadian DST to be discriminatory and burdensome to U.S. commerce, and then figure out how it is going to react to that.
So let's talk a little bit more about DSTs. A lot of taxpayers, particularly West Coast taxpayers, are actually pushing for Amount A. Why do you think that is?
It's really probably two reasons. One is that Amount A would cause existing DSTs to be withdrawn and new DSTs not to come into effect. And sort of related to that, under deals that Treasury negotiated with countries with existing DSTs, if Amount A comes into effect, then the implementing countries would provide credits against the Amount A collected in their jurisdiction to the extent that the DST collected in prior years exceeds what Amount A would have been in those prior years. So there's a potential for reducing the Amount A in the future. And then Amount A provides for relief of double taxation. So when you've got a new taxing right in the market jurisdiction under Amount A different jurisdiction has to provide relief from double taxation with respect to the amount of profits allocated to that market jurisdiction. Whereas DSTs under Notice 2023-55, Treasury position is generally DSTs are not creditable. So you've got the potential for double taxation there.
So as we've talked about several times, Pillar One also includes an Amount B, which is aimed at simplifying existing transfer pricing rules for taxpayers. Michael, what exactly is Amount B and what should we be thinking about?
Amount B is one of those rare things that I think could be a win-win-win. It's something that's really important to the IRS. It's something that could be important to taxpayers. It's also something that is very important to some of the developing countries, especially in Africa and some countries in Latin America. Amount B effectively tries to take transfer pricing disputes with respect to baseline marketing and distribution off the table. What do I mean by that? In most cases, for most multinationals in most jurisdictions, the only activity they have in that jurisdiction is some sort of marketing and maybe some distribution. And so what we've seen is that as cross-border tax disputes have exploded, a really large proportion of those disputes are about the returns to be provided to baseline marketing and distribution. So that means marketing and distribution where the distributor does not have valuable IP rights or deal with economically significant risks, those kinds of things. And what Amount B does is it says, for those cases, we're going to determine the return that's appropriate for the marketing and distribution entity on a formulaic basis, depending on the industry it's in, depending on its intensity of use of assets, and its operating expenses to sales ratio. So once you know those factors, you've got a set point return that is the price for those kinds of transactions. And the idea is to really try and take those disputes off the table in terms of doing a full, more traditional transfer pricing analysis and fighting over the interquartile range and all those kinds of things.
So we've talked about this a little bit, but there seem to be some roadblocks surrounding the policy of Amount B. What are the current issues with Amount B, and then how is that impacting the progress with respect to Amount A?
So Amount B is a red line for the U.S. in signing the Amount A MLC. So they're tightly linked, even though they are conceptually very, very different. And when I was involved in the negotiations, there were a number of countries that were opposed to having a mandatory Amount B, presumably because they believe they can get a higher return if they fight over the return with particular taxpayers rather than following this formulaic approach of Amount B. I understand that's still a sticking point, and we'll see over the next several weeks whether and how that may be resolved. So for the time being, what the inclusive framework has done is issued guidance on Amount B that says countries may adopt Amount B, and here's how it would work. That is going to be incorporated into the OECD transfer pricing guidelines. And so countries at this stage are free to adopt Amount B and apply it starting in 2025. Now, there are a couple of issues that come with that, right? One is obviously if it's optional, then if a country adopts Amount B, but the counterparty jurisdiction doesn't respect the adoption of Amount B, then that can create double tax. Now, there's some mitigation to that issue in that the inclusive framework members have committed to respecting Amount B if it's adopted by a lower capacity jurisdiction. And that needs to be defined. What is a lower capacity jurisdiction? But at least in those cases, it should not give rise to double tax because both sides of the transaction should respect that. There's also a view that the U.S. may be interested in adopting Amount B. I don't think the U.S. will be characterized as a lower capacity jurisdiction, but my hope is that the U.S. would adopt Amount B on a safe harbor basis, because to some extent, Amount B is sort of at the election of the taxpayer anyway, because taxpayers control their facts, they can structure into or out of Amount B. It will accomplish its objective better if it's done on a safe harbor basis. And that should, again, mitigate the risk of double tax in that situation. One of the benefits of the U.S. adopting Amount B would also be that in the future, if we don't get a mandatory Amount B as part of the MLC process, the IRS may be able to use Amount B on a bilateral basis with other countries who are willing to take large proportions of the transfer pricing disputes off the table and get those resolved.
To be clear, Michael, the U.S. can adopt Amount B without Senate action, correct?
That's definitely the view of Treasury and the IRS, that Amount B is designed specifically to be consistent with the arm's length principle in 482 and in U.S. treaties. And so, yes, the U.S. could adopt Amount B through regulation under 482.
Thanks, Michael. So before we conclude, do you have any final thoughts on Pillar 1? What would you say is the end goal for Pillar 1?
From a U.S. perspective, the goals are really to stabilize the international tax system and reduce its cross-border tax disputes and to prevent unilateral measures going forward. Regardless of whether Amount A comes into effect, it really is going to transform the international tax regime, because I think one of the important things about the October 2021 statement is that 140 plus countries have now agreed that the arm's length principle is not sufficient by itself to allocate profits among jurisdictions. And there's an agreement and recognition that most countries want additional market-based taxing rights. And I think that's something that's going to continue, again, regardless of whether Amount A comes into effect or not.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for joining us today to discuss Pillar One. We look forward to another podcast coming up on Pillar Two, and hopefully you can stick around for that one. But obviously, we'll be looking to you for updates on Pillar One in the future as well. So as always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.